Hey guys, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 82. This is a shaken, not stirred episode, and we'll be dissecting the film Goldfinger. Before we do all that, though, I want you to listen to this, and then pause this, and then go over to iTunes and give us a rating. That's really going to help us a lot. So, head over there, give us a 5-star rating, a 4-star, anything less than that. I think we can do better, right? So yeah, a review would be great, but that is not necessary. Definitely, though, a rating that would help us out a tremendous amount. We really appreciate that. Also, if you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at the number 3DrinksInPod. That's at 3DrinksInPod. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We have the website, 3DrinksInPodcast.com. And while you're on the iTunes, don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you never have to miss an episode. That's everything. Okay? Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Thanks.
Bond. Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. There is nothing you can talk to me about that I don't already know.
You recall us when you watched this movie?
Whenever the Superstation was playing it. It's always on the Superstation.
Always.
That and, Thunderball.
Thunderball is big.
And Diamonds Are Forever. That was always on.
Was Jaws in that one?
Yes. He was in two.
Yeah.
He was also in Moonraker.
Which one had Grace Jones in it?
I don't know who that is.
The Black Lady.
The Black Lady?
Yeah.
I don't know. Was she the henchman?
No, she's like the villain's mistress.
Oh.
She's kind of a bad guy, too.
Yeah, that's
she's
later.
Like, she's like 9 feet tall and gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, like, Grace Jones was an unusual beauty, which is why she appeared here.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate. I don't remember her. Yeah. I don't know which one she was in.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. So our rough list of things we have to cover. The pre-title sequence. The song.
Oh, Grace Jones. Oh, yeah.
Title title graphics. The villain, the henchman, the girl, the gadgets, the car, the watch. I don't think there's much of a watch in this one. The tuxedo, the fights, the deaths, and the number 13, the plot.
Well, the whole movie, basically.
Those are all things we'll try to hit. Well, yeah, but like one at a time this way. Everyone's guessing this one. All right, so the pre-title sequence. This was the first pre-title sequence.
No, the last one was.
The first one where they... Right, but that one, like, it didn't have it. It was a connected thing, right?
Right, the last one that was connected. Like this one wasn't so much.
Yeah, they kill the guy that looks like James Bond.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's kind of like a foreshadowing of what's to come. But this was totally... And this movie really sort of set the stage for the rest of them. It created the format by which the other ones were designed, up until the Daniel Craig ones, which sort of took that and tinkered a little bit with it, but not hugely. Like it wasn't like ridiculous. This established this is what they're gonna do, and they do the opening thing that has nothing to do with the rest of the story. It's just. Which, when you think about it, is really smart. You know, I constantly reference Bill Goldman's books about screenwriting, and he says that you always want to begin your story in the middle. You know, that was one of the best things about Hell or High Water, I thought, was that, like, all the stuff, like, to get the plot going had already happened, and you were literally in the middle of their first bank robbery when the movie starts. And by having the Bond movie start off in the middle of an adventure that's not necessarily related to this one, it's smart. You just, you get thrown in the action. There's no wait time. This is exciting immediately. And then you get to the rest of the story and they go through the regular, beginning of a story plot stuff after the title card sequence.
Well, I only think it's stupid when it's like, you know, the 20th Bond film. Because let's say it's you haven't seen any Bond movies and then this one comes out. This is only the third Bond movie. And you're watching him do all these crazy action scenes and the, you know, the tuxedo under the wetsuit and things like that. You're like, okay, now I got a good idea of what this guy is like. He's murderous. He's also debonair. He's got nifty gadgets. So you learn everything about Bond. And then once the movie starts, you're like, you know what you're expecting. Instead of saying, James Bond is an international spy who uses pens, lasers, and you know, shit like that. But then after a while, it's like, I don't know why I'm still watching this. I know he's like, you know, after a while, it's kind of like repetitive.
Yeah, and that's why I think when they got to Pierce Brosnan and them, the stuff that happened in the beginning was kind of connected.
It became up to you to figure out how that related to the rest of the movie, which I liked. It was like a little mystery, you know?
Right. Like, I think the best one in my mind, and I think it's because this is the best movie, is the one from Casino Royale. Because you have, you know, it's you're introducing the character for the first time, and you're you know, there's the two different modes. He's in the calm, cool assassin mode, and then he's in that's juxtaposed with the brutal fight in the bathroom. Yeah. And they're both telling you the same thing. Like, this is, he's new at this. And, you know, in the one half of the scene where the guy's talking, you're getting the information verbally. And in the other half, you're watching him kind of stumble around trying to beat this guy up in the bathroom and not doing very well until
he... Yeah, it's difficult. The end.
But that's connected to, not so much to the plot at all, but to the character's sort of rebirth, you know, in that in those
yeah films. That's good for the character, because like there had been a break, and this they were clearly trying to say this is a new James Bond who's new at this. And I always think of the one in GoldenEye, because he shoots his friend, like his friend gets shot, and he decides, well, then I have less time to blow this place up with my friend's dead body inside, and that the important thing is the mission. And you find out, holy shit, the bad guy's really his friend, and you get the sense of their relationship. You know, he's mad. You were more important to the mission than to me, and blah blah blah.
Yeah, and like, I think in I can't recall what happens in Die Another Day, for Christ's sakes, but that's when they were in North Korea.
Yeah, that one connects too, and you're like, what does this have? The guy with the diamonds in his face, you know.
Good God. But even like, you know, Tomorrow Never Dies, that's they introduced the encoder for the GPS that's tracking system. Which
don't want to tamper with that. You could start World War III.
No. It's very important. But yeah, I guess the more I think about it, yeah, the later post Roger Moore films had much more connectivity. Yeah. That's a word to the plot. Whereas Roger Moore, it was just about one-upping yourself.
Right, like what silly thing can we have him do now that won't fit into the rest of the movie, you know?
Like where he skis off the mountain into like, and then like with the parachute with the British flag on the back. The
jetpacks.
Subtle. You know,
can't wait till we get to those movies. Yeah.
But this one was pretty straightforward, you know. The whole thing was about how he could, you know, scuba dive in a tuxedo under a wetsuit and then get out. And
doesn't he have
dry.
Like the duck hat? Like it looks like he's got a duck on his head.
It's kind of tongue in cheek. It's fun. And then like he gets out and his you know, one of his tubes for his thing is filled with plastic explosive, and he blows up
a factory.
It's like they're
manufacturing
there.
Drugs.
Yeah, it's a drug lab. This positively shocking.
God. Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about it. And he sees the guy's reflection in her eye.
I mean, I like that stuff because that was kind of, I don't know, I wasn't alive. But that seems kind of unique that you have to really be watching the screen to see what's going on. Like, oh, he's looking at her eyeball and he's seeing. So if you're not really paying attention, you might miss that.
It also sets up what made Sean Connery the best, was that he was the most brutal, efficient person at murdering others, but also, like, you know, he enjoyed whiskey and wine and women, and He could be debonair, but also be a bastard if he had to. Nobody else pulled that off quite as well, and they wrote it like that for him. You know, like he was willing to make out with that girl until he was like, "Never mind, I'm going to put her in between me and this gangster, and let her get clubbed on the head."
That's true. He does. He spins her around, and she gets whacked over.
And
the
he just
back
like tosses her aside. I'm like, okay, done with this one now.
Yeah, and right now you get all kinds of calls about that one. But, I mean, the thing about that, too, is that he could sell that, and it didn't seem awkward. Like, Pierce Brosnan tried that, and it didn't always work. You know, he would alternate between being suave and charming and funny and then deadly serious. And I don't know what Sean Connery did to make that work, but... You know, you can't really do that. I mean, I think Daniel Craig is successful at it because he never really lets his guard down. And he's funny, but he's so dry that, like, there's barely any charm there. He's just so good looking, and his eyes are blue that you don't really, like, the girls are
like, he's funny,
really,
but I wouldn't say he's charming. Like, they present him as, like, a brutish kind of guy with a wit that's more of a sarcastic, like, I'm a bit of a dick, you know?
Yeah, which is like a thing girls like sometimes. Sure. And so, like, that's the angle that they're going with him, is that, like, girls always like the bad boy, and he's the bad boy. And Sean Connery doesn't present himself as the bad boy to women. You know, so he can kind of alternate between that. But, like, Brosnan's movies had tonal problems throughout, bouncing back and forth between comedies and serious action films. And his performance has the same problem. Connery didn't really have that, which is you're right. Why he's the best. So, all right. What did the I can't remember what the what do you call it? The title sequence was for this one
when they were singing Goldfinger with Shirley Bassey.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I'm googling it now.
It's all the women painted gold, and they were just reflecting the movie on them.
Right?
Yeah. The title sequences weren't very interesting or good for like a long time.
No,
this one was still like
they got better.
Whatever. Just long credits that you can't skip whenever you watch it on TV. You know.
Yeah, I'm watching it now.
Yeah, it was okay. People love that song. It's okay. It's an okay song. I don't know.
I fucking hate that song. Am I the only one?
I mean, yeah, you are. But it's not a great song either.
Goldfinger! That's what she sounds like to me.
Yeah.
It's so good. I mean, it's better than, like, you know, Nancy Sinatra.
Review to a Kill, which is by Duran Duran, which was the worst. And I think that's the only one that won, like... You know, a Grammy or something for like original song. I hate that song.
Well, the Skyfall won something, an Oscar,
yeah,
I think.
That's a great song.
Yeah. That's a great freaking song.
That was probably the best part of the movie.
Yeah. But. So it's not a bad movie.
Yeah, we'll get there. But yeah, I mean, what else? So then the title song opening, and then.
Title song, you know, it's. And, did they show previously in the other ones, like, clips of the film? It was kind of Mission Impossible-esque like that, where they showed you a few things that you would see later on.
I don't think they did.
I think that was kind of new.
I mean, this is only the third one, and Dr. No had a very skimpy opening. You know, like, it kind of just got to it. I think the last one, I don't really remember.
Yeah.
Whatever it had, it obviously didn't stand out.
Oh, there was the belly dancers.
Yeah, belly dancers. Like, how far can we push this, you know?
Yeah, it was just silhouettes of naked ladies.
Yeah, I mean, this is 1964, so even the women
Big
in
deal.
The opening of this one, you could still see they had bikinis on. Like, let's not get crazy here, you know?
It was still pretty racy for the time,
yeah,
I'd
like,
imagine.
Is this what we can get away with? Or yeah, so it was okay.
Yeah. It was fine. Okay, the villain...
The villain. Oh, Mr. Bond. Where was he supposed to be from?
Germany.
Was it Germany? He was German?
I'm pretty sure he was supposed to be a German guy. The actor himself was German, and he was not comfortable speaking English.
No.
As was made clear by the fact he was kind of awkward with it. I'm looking to see where the hell... Auric Goldfinger, yeah. Which a little on the nose.
This is the movie that started a lot of that stuff. Like you said, this is the quintessential Bond that set the tone and the standard for everything.
Now, it says here in Wikipedia that Orson Welles was considered for the role, but he was going to cost him too much money. Could you imagine Orson Welles?
I can't imagine Orson Welles doing much of anything besides Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane and the President of Hollywood.
He could be the standard rich and famous contract. The President of Hollywood. Only the Muppets could come up with that.
Yeah. And he was supposed to be British, but like that was the thing. Like you, but you'd never know it to listen to him. And
but so what did you think of this villain then?
I mean, everything about him is great until they get to that scene when they have all the mobsters from around the country. You know, we measure everything, you know, and you know they give out awards for everything except crime, he says. And I'm just like, wait. Oh, wait, he was dubbed.
Oh, he was?
It says here. Yeah. He was portrayed by Gert Frobe and dubbed by Michael Collins. Mm. Not the astronaut or the IRA guy, but probably somebody else. Yeah. I mean, I actually like him as a villain. It's that he has that one weak moment where they give him this, but that's more of a writing issue. But it's this great kind of thing where he's not himself at all dangerous. Like, physically, he's not imposing at all. There's no sort of, you know, in From Russia With Love, the bad guy is the organization, but really it's Robert Shaw's character, whose name I can't think of right now. And, like, he's the bad guy. And in Dr. No is sort of superhuman with his crazy hands. But this is, you know, he's just the brains. There's nothing really...
Well, that's kind of what happens. That becomes the Bond standard. There's the villain, and then there's the henchman, who's usually gigantic. And I love how, when they get to Tomorrow Never Dies, they just picked a giant German guy. Like, well, what's his shtick? He's just really, really big. And they're probably sitting in the writing room like, I don't know, what if he's just, like, really strong? Yeah, that's fine, you know? We've done it all here.
We're tired of trying to think of a gimmick.
Yeah, the gimmick is that he's tall and he lifts a lot of weight. You know?
And he looks pretty much like a Nazi. Is that scary enough for you?
He's got a crew cut. Sort of.
It's blonde hair.
That was their thing, right? Right. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So I mean, yeah, he's. I mean, he has that iconic moment, and now that I know that it's dubbed, it's sort of like I didn't know that. It kind of ruins it. But when he's got him, you know, chained to the table with the laser, he's gonna cut him in half, and you know. It's just that great line. He goes, "Do you expect me to talk?" And he goes, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." That kind of stuff makes this character for you because, you know, they go back and forth about secret plans and grand things and little models, and they play golf for a half an hour.
It's a great golfing scene.
That's kind of boring. But when it comes to this, he's like, "I'm just going to kill you. I don't need anything from you." I think that's what makes the character so kind of terrifying is that you don't really know what's going on with him for a long time, and you follow Bond as the investigator, but you're in the dark for most of the movie, even though you think you're not.
Right.
Like you think the whole time, well, he's just going to steal all this gold. That's his thing, right? And Bond thinks he has the the edge on him, and he never really does until the end.
No, I mean, Bond spent most of the movie captured, so. Right. But that, I remember, because our father was very, very big into James Bond. He loved, you know, he was from an older era, our father, when men were men, that kind of thing. And so he knew all the Bond movies. He read all the books. And he used to just say about the villains, I was like, he's like, that's the thing with the villains, he would say. They're all a little nuts. Like, they have to be nuts. Like, yes, they're scary. Yes, they're ruthless. And they're extremely violent, some of them. But they're all crazy at the same time. So whatever their plan is, it has to be beyond the scope of what we would normally expect. And that's, and I always used to tell people, like, that's why superhero things work and James Bond works. You need a character like James Bond or Superman to combat things that normal people can't combat. Okay, so this guy, he's got a plan to blow up Fort Knox to increase the value of his gold. That's nuts. And most people wouldn't be able to handle that. You need a guy who could go in there and screw that up. Someone superhuman to stop a supervillain plan, you know?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit because there's some inconsistencies with what's going on there.
So I thought he was good. Like, you know, Dr. No, okay, I'm going to start a war, whatever. He's kind of scary, I guess. This guy, smart, you know, brutal. He has henchmen working for him that are also pretty brutal. So he came across pretty good. You know, the double entendre names are kind of dumb, but it's still sort of tongue-in-cheek, so you sort of, like, laugh it off.
Yeah. What do you think of Oddjob?
Well, Oddjob's a classic. You can't knock Oddjob.
I don't know about the hat, but the fact that he was as strong as a brick shithouse.
Yeah, well, I always laugh because, like, he would throw the hat, and then he wouldn't have it. Like, it didn't come back.
Yeah. It's not a boomerang. No. It's just a bowler hat.
There were certain scenes, where, like, in the end of the fight scene, when he throws it at Bond, and it gets lodged in the bars. You're like, oh, I guess it's a bit of a one-off, isn't it? Like, well, like, what if he throws it too high, and now he can't get it, because he's pretty small.
Yeah. it's pretty racist by today's standards, too, in a sense.
Really? How do you figure?
Well, he never speaks.
So?
I don't know. Like, and I'm just basing off of what I know people would, you know, overreact to. You know, it's not quite Mickey Rooney. It's he's an actual Korean man,
right?
But yeah, it's just not, I don't know. I would think that today that wouldn't go over very well.
They did that with Dave Bautista's character in the last one. He didn't speak either.
Right, which was that a strength, or I don't know. Like, sometimes silence can be very effective, and I'm not so sure if it worked in the case of David.
I think it works for Oddjob because Oddjob doesn't just appear. Like, Goldfinger talks about him like he's not even standing there, and so you see, like, okay, this guy for whatever reason works for him. And has no problem chopping people's heads off. Whereas Dave Bautista just shows up, gouges the guy's eyeballs out, sits down, and no one comments on anything. So, like...
Yeah, that was a big part of that movie.
So, he has no motivation of any kind. And, like, he was just sort of there. So, yeah. So with Oddjob, I sort of get it. Like, he's just the muscle.
Yeah. He can crush a golf ball. That was pretty good.
I think
that entire golfing scene was just to get to that point where he crushes the golf ball.
Like, how can we work this in? And, like, that's like his only line where he goes like, ah, ah. Like, he makes like a barking noise.
Yeah, I think that was sort of what I was getting at. Like, he doesn't talk. It seems he seems borderline retarded.
Wow.
You know, I don't know.
But I like him, man. And, you know. It's become an iconic thing. Everyone knows that character. Even if you've never seen the movie, you're like, oh, yeah, the guy throws the hat because it's so odd.
I remember when they spoofed it in Austin Powers, he threw it through his shoe.
Random desk.
Who throws his shoe? Honestly. Who throws his shoe?
Then he gets hit with it, and he's just like, ow, that hurts.
That really like nothing hurt. happened. All right. All right, the girl. There are like three girls in this movie.
You dog. Yeah.
So there's Jill Masterson, who's the one who's working for him, helping him cheat at cards in the beginning. And, I mean, she's only there just to get to that terrifying thing where, like, she's covered in gold paint. And his skin suffocation is what she dies from. Is that a thing? Let's
Google
that.
I'm told that's
that.
Not a skin thing. Because even if you breathe through your mouth, you're going to get oxygen. I don't know why they didn't just, like, knock her out or strangle her and then paint her in gold. Be like, she was strangled. I wonder by who.
NBC News, James Bond lied to us. Death by gold paint, unlikely.
Yeah.
And I can't tell when this article was written. But yeah, no, I mean, I guess she was unconscious, but we don't breathe through our skin. So it sort of doesn't make a lot of sense. But, I mean, it was cool. And they mimicked that in, what was the bad one? Quantum of Solace.
Oh, when she's in the oil.
Yeah, they cover her in oil. But I think she was dead already. It was just like kind of sending him a message. Like, we're evil. We have oil that we can just waste and cover people with it.
Yeah. I don't know. It's so many things that we... I mean, three things already. You know, Odd Job, the girl with the paint, the opening sequence. All these things are so iconic in, like, American pop culture. You know?
Yeah.
And I could think of... when he has the giant model under the floor and the laser cutting scene. Like, so much of this stuff was popularized and new at the time. So
even her name, Pussy Galore, the next one. Jesus Christ.
I feel like douchey when I say it.
I don't like saying that name.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
And her name was actually, like, the actress's name was kind of cool. It was Honor Blackman. That was her real name.
Well, they should have just gone with that.
God.
Instead of saying pussy the entire time, you know, like that. Like, oh, pussy.
Yeah, it just... it, not quite sure. Was that a Fleming thing? Was that her name in the book?
He came up with that stuff. Yeah, like, he came up with a lot of them, and then they made 10 times more for the movies, but...
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. And I did happen to think that it was funny that when... they get to Casino Royale, and he and Eva Green get in the car. He's going over their cover stories. My name is so and so, and you're Miss Stephanie Broadchested.
You're just gonna have to trust me on this one. Yeah,
it was great. So, I mean, she was probably the best part of the movie, as far as like probably the best Bond girl, I would say, in that, you know, she gave as good as she got, kind of thing. She was really
tough.
Sort of in, she was tough. She wasn't a pushover.
And, you know, one could say she's the hero because she saves the day.
Essentially, yeah.
Bond doesn't do too much.
Well, to be fair, he had to have sex with her first.
So his penis is the hero. That's what I was really getting at. That's the day. Once again, Bond has saved the day with his enormous schlong. You're welcome.
There's even hay. They had a roll in the hay.
And they probably were like filming it like, you know what? We should probably get some hay for this scene. Just to really drive home the puns. Howard, you've done it again, you know? Like, that's a great idea.
We're going to leave out any ambiguity whatsoever.
I don't want anyone going home going, what was the point of that scene? And who was the other girl?
Right.
There was three.
And then there was whatchamacallit?
Her sister, right?
There was the girl in the hotel in Miami, and then there was her sister who he meets up with later. She's like gonna take her out, and then like he just kind of just tells her, "Look, I've got this. I'll take over from here." And then you don't really see her again. And there's like the whole bit with the car and the ejector seat in the car.
The ejector seat was like a big deal. That whole Q stuff was big that time, you know.
Yeah, they really kind of dove into it. It wasn't just like, here's a new gun for you. It's like
rotating license plates, you know.
Yeah, and there was an oil slick. There was a machine gun. There was the rotating license plates, ejector seat. Anything else in there that I'm missing?
Yeah, the shield.
Bulletproof shield, which now seems kind of quaint because you just make the glass bulletproof.
Well,
which they have. Yeah. Like, you know.
I never liked that scene where Oddjob is holding like the mirror, and Bond just thinks he's going to drive into another car, and Oddjob is standing in the woods holding a mirror, like reflecting the headlights back, and Bond crashes into a tree, and Oddjob's just standing there like, got him, oldest trick in the book, the old mirror in the middle of the street trick, and I was like, wow, that is so lame. It's like they ran out of ideas. Like, I don't know, what if he sees his reflection?
Two old guys with cigars banging away at typewriters. What do you think?
Do we have anything for that? For the car to... No, there's nothing for the reverse mirror trick. So, okay.
So what are the gadgets we're in this one since we're talking about the car?
Crap. I don't remember.
Let's see. James Bond gadgets.
Because he doesn't start getting the really
the
crazy
tracking
stuff.
Device.
Yeah, like he still has normal devices.
Yeah, which is fine. No, the seagull headgear, the grappling gun. Fine.
He doesn't need to have the laser pen and the belt grappling hook.
Yeah. I'm on a site called 007james.com, and it's just like lists all the gadgets in the movie, and it's like everything from like the squeezy tube of plastic explosives to the heat lamp. This is the first time that you saw Q's laboratory too.
Yeah, well, before he was always like in the room with M, like, here's your gun, you know. And then they start making the gag that he goes down to the lab where they're doing stuff and testing.
It's all kind of like, you know, crazy shit.
Like setting guys on fire to see how the trench coats would work.
You know, and it really, what do you call it? Oh, wait, no, yeah, he kills that woman.
The sister? Realized,
sister, Oddjob takes her out with the
hat. Yeah, no, she gets killed.
I forgot about that. I thought she was just, like, abandoned. No, she actually dies. Boy, that family is down two sisters.
Well, they should probably not help people cheat at cards.
Yeah. Good Lord. And the ultimate gadget, the atomic bomb.
Well, he can't strap that to his pant leg. I'm not sure that counts as a gadget.
Speaking of pants, included in the gadgets was the Oddjob's trouser pocket with the hole in it.
Oh, where he sneaks that.
He sneaks the bolt. This website's very thorough.
I think it's a little forgiving, too. I have that in my coat pocket. I wouldn't consider that a gadget. It's just a tear. You know, it's a popped seam.
All right. Did the car, did the gadgets. I don't think he has a watch in this one. They don't make a big deal out of it. Like, the watch wasn't a gadget or anything. It might have been just like your standard Rolex. Yeah.
Like, he had one.
Yeah. Yeah, but it wasn't like a thing.
It might have like a garrote thing in it, but like a wire for choking people, but I don't think he does any of that.
I don't think so. All right, the fight sequences. I thought they were, you know, pretty good for the time. I mean, back then, the sort of the fight choreography wasn't what it is now, and the Foley artist work wasn't, because, like, you know, it always seems kind of cheap, and I'm just gonna kick my foot near your face, and you hear that thwomp and fall over. I will say this: the sound effects are much more realistic in a way in these old movies. Like, now it sounds like they're slapping meat whenever somebody else gets a good punch in the schnoz.
Yeah, because I don't think when people get punched, it really makes that much noise.
It makes almost no noise
so
whatsoever.
Now, like, people kind of expect it to make noise, like a kung fu movie, so they kind of put it in there.
There was this whole article I read the other day about silencers in movies.
I don't really silence things.
And yeah, like apparently the only way you get that kind of like that thump, thump, thump is from like a 22 caliber, which really can barely do any damage at all. But anything that makes a supersonic sound when it comes out of the gun, like it's still going to sound like a gun. It's just going to be a little easier on your ears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's not like a hand cannon at that point. It's just a little muffled. It's not like a totally silent, blowgun or something.
So, one more thing: Hollywood's ruined silencers and punching people. So when you do it, it just hurts a lot, and you know, it hurts you, even though you're the one.
You're more likely to break your own hand. So, I like the fight scenes because the first two movies didn't really have much of a fight scene. Like Dr. No barely had anything.
That's not true.
The last one had the train one with Robert Shaw.
The train one, and I guess the beginning is kind of a fight where he kills the guy that looks like Connery kind of thing. Yeah.
There's a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this one had like sort of like your standard Bond fight sequences where you, he uses the electrocution thing a couple of times, and like Oddjob gets it. Like it all kind of, it's just much more intense and much more sort of grandiose kind of.
Yeah, there's less gunfights. Like there's more hand to hand stuff.
Yeah, which makes sense because I mean, gunfights are essentially pretty dull.
Yeah, especially from
westerns are pretty good at it, but that's just because it's a six shooter and they're going to run out of bullets. But like the gun battle in the movie Heat with Al Pacino goes on for like a half an hour and it's really kind of dull. Like people die and that's what's sort of intense about it. But after a while, it's just exhausting. Pulling out like a fully automatic
thing. I mean, this one also set the standard for he has to have a fight with the henchman now. He has the knockdown drag out with Oddjob in the vault. Where even though he's tiny, and Sean Connery, who's not very tall, but taller than this guy.
Sean Connery's very tall. Are you kidding me?
Connery?
Yeah, he's like 6'3".
Are you sure?
Yeah.
All right, well, at least taller than Oddjob. Very tall. Anyway, so.
Everyone's tall than Oddjob.
So, but they still have a big fight about it. So that's...
Right. I mean...
Nice.
Sean Connery height 6'2".
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's pretty tall. I mean, which makes that harder to stage because it can't look like this guy's just walloping on this little Asian man.
Yeah, no, that's not allowed.
Yeah. All right. So, as far as the overall plot is concerned, What do you think worked especially well that made this movie? Because the story had to be pretty good. You can do all the iconic stuff you want, but it's only iconic because people really enjoyed the story. So what do you think was especially effective about what they did in this movie versus what they did in like some of the other ones, which had more stupid plots?
So this one has. Still a not great plot, but this one has the big twist, which is that he's not actually going to rob Fort Knox. Right. And I think everybody's become very numb to it now because it's been spoofed 1,000 times. But if it's 1964 and you're watching this guy do ridiculous things to get gold, and then he looks like he's going to try to rob Fort Knox, and he goes, "I'm not going to try to rob Fort Knox." You're like, "Well, what the hell else could he be doing with it? Right. I'm going to blow it up and make mine even more valuable." I'd be like, "Oh, that's different. That's cool." It's insane because he'll destroy people and lives and buildings as well. It's an atomic bomb. It's not like the bomb gets contained inside a little vault. So that's where the insanity comes in.
Well, I think part of that has to do with the fact that not everyone had an understanding of how those bombs worked. Like, because of pop culture and because we've had, these bombs for the last, you know, 70 years, we have a better understanding of the physics of it. It's also not as classified or mysterious or terrifying as it. I mean, yeah, it's terrifying, but, you know, back in 64, pretty much 64, especially 64, because that was just after Kennedy was shot and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and everybody was, like, sort of hyper aware of any moment where, you know, we're all going to be annihilated kind of thing. Whereas that's not our daily living experience at this point. We're not terrified of that every day. I mean, you are if you live in Seoul, but beyond that, you're not really afraid of this kind of thing happening to you. So you could kind of play up on people's fears by saying, you know, we have an atomic bomb and we're going to detonate it here. And there was enough ignorance about what that would mean for that plot to kind of pass muster with your average audience. And there was enough fear that you didn't really care what it meant. It was just sounded sure. terrifying. Because if you think about it, like, the United States has a deposit of gold. Yes, it's at Fort Knox, but it's also not exactly how our economy works. And it isn't even how it worked back then. And Roosevelt took the country off the gold standard. And so the exact amount of gold in the vault was not necessarily, you know, directly tied to the economy. Now, it would have been bad. Oh, yeah,
it would have been bad. I mean, it is still important. Gold is still the most rare, you know, one of the most rare commodities and things on the planet. But, you know, for a guy, you're watching this thing, like, the guy cares so much he's willing to annihilate this entire area and kill thousands and thousands of people just to make his gold a little more valuable. And you're like, holy crap, this guy's totally nuts.
Although what I didn't quite get is, like, well, if the gold just sits there, you know, it isn't like you're taking it to the store and buying anything with it. You know, what would it matter that you couldn't touch it?
Oh, well, I mean, I guess the idea is that you could if you had to.
Like, yeah. And you couldn't.
Right. If it was completely radioactive. You couldn't even get near it. You'd be like, well, you know what? Let's just take that off the market.
Again, it would be bad. We're not saying that this wouldn't have been a problem.
And it's also interesting that this is the first time. I mean, they kind of allude to it a little bit in the other ones with the, not Spectre, they were called Smersh or whatever they were. He's not any country. He's not the USSR. He's just on his own. So you're right. Like, okay, this guy is totally nuts, but he has the capability as an independent individual to cause a lot of mayhem.
Yeah. He was a member of Smersh in the books, but in the... In the film, I think that was the right choice to make him not a part of that because, you know, for the first two movies, you heard about this secret organization and they were evil and whatever. And this guy, he's just as crazy and just as evil, but he's not connected to them. So you get a broader sense of just the kind of people that Bond would have to deal with in his line of work. It's not just, you know, one organization against the other.
Right.
It's independent contractors.
Kind of thing. And that gets stale after a while too, where it's like a lot of the later movies are people from Russia or people from Cuba or like the communists basically. Like, oh, we're always fighting the communists. It's like, well, no, this guy's not any of that stuff. He's just in it for himself, you know? And how do you, and I always think it's funny with these old Bond movies where they just send him and they go, find out what this guy is up to. We don't trust him. Like, they don't know any more than Bond does. It's up to Bond to sort of investigate what's really happening. You don't get the whole plot in the first 20 minutes, which is nice.
Yeah. Which is actually what was one of the weakest parts about Quantum of Solace. But it also makes for an interesting movie. If a guy has to go into a situation, treat it like a mystery, act like a cop, and try to, you know, investigate to figure out what's going on. But for some reason with Bond, that doesn't work now. You just look kind of like, well, why don't you know anything? Well, like, this guy's just walking around beating people up, trying to figure out what's going
on. Right. Like they that's why they allude to him more nowadays as more of like a hitman or assassin than a spy. Like, he doesn't do the fake name thing, And it got silly with the Bond movies after a while. Like, clearly the guy's been around. He uses his real name. That's stupid. But in the older ones, he was doing spy work. You know? I don't know something, and I need to find out what it is. And it just happens to have a license to kill. So if he has to kill someone, I could just put a bullet between his eyes instead of getting a warrant. You know? Right. So I think the plot of this movie is one of the better ones.
Oh, yeah. As far as the early ones go, it's pretty strong. It's just, you know, our modern sensibilities tend to poke holes in things the longer I look at them.
Yeah, but, you know, it was fun. That's what our father always loved about them, too. He was like, it's a fun movie. It's not, you're not supposed to take it that seriously. Just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know.
Which is, again, a product of our current, you know, point of view about these things is that, and you could make a pretty strong case that the new Bond movies take themselves way too seriously, that they're not so much fun anymore.
I wouldn't describe any of the Daniel Craig movies as fun. Great movies. Like Casino Royale is a great movie, but fun? I don't know. Yeah.
Like what?
I wouldn't take my girlfriend to see it or whatever. So.
So this is... Now this begins a long stretch of these things where they just kind of like, okay, well, we have the format.
Yeah.
Just kind of and then move along.
Yeah, well, pretty much. I mean, this one made, I don't know, two or three times as much as the other ones combined. I mean, this was a huge, huge film. And
a budget of $3 million in the box office made $125 million. That's so much money.
It's absurd how much money it made. You know,
oh, man.
Deservedly so. It was a good movie. My only problem is, you know, they didn't bother to tinker with it after that. You know, like the plots got more outlandish. Like, you know, we should just do that again.
Yeah, they sort of said, okay, we got it. This is it. Yeah,
but faster. You know.
Was there anything that you didn't like about it?
I don't like that Bond spends most of the movie captured. You know?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really do a whole lot. Yes, he sleeps with Pussy Galore, and she's the one who switches the canister of nerve gas with, like, nothing. Which is the worst scene, where she flies over Fort Knox, and all the guys, like, drop down to pretending that they're knocked out. It's like just the worst acting.
I was trying to think, like, that's
yeah, weird. And then they all like stand up immediately.
Oh,
just
we're
kidding,
fine.
You know. And you know, that's a little stupid, but you know, Bond spends a lot of his time, like, he's captured, so he's just constantly like, what are we doing now? What's the plan, huh? Why don't you tell me? And then Goldfinger just tells him. And keeps him around. I'm like,
and then he starts monologuing.
Yeah. I always think of that scene in Austin Powers where he's like, why are we doing this? Why don't we just kill him right now? Like, I have a gun in my room right now. I'll go get it. He's like, no, we're going to strap him to the room with the sharks with the lasers and all this stuff. Yeah.
It's hilarious. This is the, speaking of money, it's the 15th most profitable Bond film. Yeah.
What's the first?
Skyfall.
Really?
$304 million.
Is that adjusted for inflation?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, no, it's all like, you know, current, like whatever the hell they made at the time. But Spectre actually came in at $100 million less.
Then,
which I was surprised about.
This?
Then Skyfall.
Oh, Spectre wasn't that good.
I guess. I thought it was kind of better than Skyfall, but
Spectre, really? Huh. I mean, I didn't like Skyfall that much, so. But Spectre was just okay.
Oh, adjusted for ticket price inflation, the most profitable one was Thunderball.
Oh, okay.
$661 million. Goldfinger comes up right behind that with $586 million.
Hmm.
Yeah. That's a lot of money.
Well, these things just sort of started, they started printing money, these movies. I mean, that's why they could do whatever they wanted, the later ones.
Yeah. I mean, the format works. It's, you know, it's straightforward. It's a lot of fun, you know, and there's something comforting in the predictability of it, I think, at the same time. Like, people liked knowing, okay, this is the part where this is going to happen. How are they going to do it this time? You know, it sort of started that whole thing, which I don't think existed in films before at all. It's certainly not.
It's pretty rare. You know,
they didn't have 25 movies. But that you could essentially do the same thing over and over again with little tweaks here and there. And, you know, this is sort of how we now view most movies that we talk about, is that, you know, all these superhero films kind of have to hit the same points. They, you know, they can't deviate too far from it, otherwise you're not really making a superhero movie. But as far as you can go, I think, is probably The Dark Knight. You know, that's like the movie that came, it was not drastically different, but different enough from most superhero movies that people were upset that they didn't consider it for Best Picture kind of thing. And, but this movie began the process of, we can simply make the same thing repeatedly with minor adjustments to things. And people will, you know, they'll still enjoy that, even though they're basically getting the exact same product.
No, that's fine. I mean, it's,
and if you think about it,
what people like.
Oh, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, and I mean, I complain a lot now about, well, you know, they don't make, you know, individual movies anymore. Everything's got to be part of a franchise or a universe or something like that, and you know. We talk about the 1970s as like the golden age of film in a lot of ways, where you got things like The Godfather and Dog Day Afternoon and all these movies that, you know, The Godfather had a couple of sequels, sure, but, you know, they were unique films, and they stood on their own, and they told individual stories, and characters were real and gritty and, you know, human and, you know, not made of steel. And, you know, but so it was. You could put the blame at James Bond's feet for the fact that, you know, he invented this concept that we are all, that Disney and Warner Brothers are trying to capitalize on so much, that you can just make roughly the same film a bunch of times and have characters people already are familiar with.
I don't know that much about Eon Productions, which is the production company. It's English, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, they were British. I mean, the guy, Cubby Broccoli.
Yeah, Harry Saltzman.
And Alexander Saltzman, mm-hmm. I think his name was. Harry Saltzman, sorry. Yeah. I'm thinking of Alexander Salkind, the guy who produced Superman. Yeah. Yeah. Different guys. Yeah. I forget if Saltzman was British, but Broccoli wasn't British. He was born in the Bronx, I think. But he just loved British culture, and he spent a lot of time living in England. And there's a really great documentary. It was on Netflix a long time ago, called Everything or Nothing. Yeah, it was, which is what Eon.
What strikes me is
for.
That, and it's not so much an American thing as it is a British thing. That if you can't get the same stuff, you just keep doing it and pretend it didn't happen. So like. You know, Sean Connery didn't want to do it anymore. And they were like, well, we're making way too much money. Let's just get someone else and pretend it's nothing's happened. And I always think of like Doctor Who, which has been on for like 60 years or whatever. They're like, well, we'll just get another guy. Pretend it's the same guy. Who cares? Like, nobody cares. Whereas like in America, that's just not done. You know, and like when they made the second Jaws, they were like, we have to have Roy Scheider. We can't do another Jaws without him. It's like, you could have, because you did later. But in America, it's like, well, the guy's not here, so what do we do? Well,
I wonder if that's something to do with the different ways that the British and the Americans think about
could they?
Theatrical performance. Yeah, I mean. Like we've talked before about, like the British have a very different way of thinking about acting than most Americans do. Americans are very, very heavily influenced by the Russians and people like Lee Strasberg, who's in Godfather 2. He plays the Jewish guy. Stella Adler is another big acting name from the 50s and 60s. These people learned a lot from the Russian Stanislavski, and they opened up schools of acting that lent themselves very well to film. And it was all about internalizing all of your emotions. And, you know, Dustin Hoffman is the best known method actor, where you take everything and you find a connection to yourself, and you draw on your own personal experiences, and everything happens inside your brain. And you try to make that, which is works really great for film, because then you don't do anything too big. You know, you're acting for a camera. All your behavior is small. It's tiny. But the British have a lot more experience with stage acting, and a lot of their theater schools are, you know, they provide access to, you know, their ideas are bigger and broader. And so the person playing the role is less important than the role. You know, like who's playing Doctor Who doesn't really matter. Doctor Who is the interesting person. And it's a very presentational way of looking at of storytelling, whereas the Americans are, like Sherlock is a good example of this. Like there's a lot of things in, you know, like the use of text on screen and visual things that happen in the TV show Sherlock that you just don't see that in American TV. You know, there wouldn't be things that, you know, like whenever he goes into his mind palace or he's thinking about things, show you what he's thinking.
And like to me, like it's
not like a hyper accurate thing.
It's silly I'm watching it level, and also on like on a deeper level. So like as soon as you put on Roger Moore versus Sean Connery, my brain is already going, who is this person? And it takes me 5 minutes to figure, okay, this is James Bond. Gotcha. And on a deeper level, Roger Moore is not Sean Connery. And he does not pull off the suave, debonair, ladies' man persona that Sean Connery can do. He just doesn't have that. He doesn't have that skill. And so he might be ruthless, and he might be funny and quippy, but he's bringing something different. So every time they're like, well, it's the same guy. It's still James Bond. Yeah, but every actor brings something different, and every actor has their own unique skill set. And Roger Moore was better at just making horrible puns all the time. Well, that's why we sit here and we debate who's the best James Bond and who's the best Superman or Batman or whatever, you know. Val Kilmer had different skills than Christian Bale. And what's funny with Bond movies is that
is that the truth?
There was no break for a lot of these things. Like the longest time between movies, 5-6 years. I mean, all these early movies in the 60s came out like 2 years apart almost. You know, so yeah.
Yeah.
So George Lazenby, 1969, Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Squished between 1967, You Only Live Twice, and 1971, Diamonds Are Forever. That in the mind of most people, that's not enough time to tell me this is a new person. So
I think it is a very kind of British.
British television, but I mean, I watch more than I want to because my mother and I share a television. And oh my god, I just watched Call the Midwife last week. Oh, it's a half an hour of people still crying, stillborn babies, giving them up for adoption, and then they want them back. I just looked at my mother like, how can you watch this? This is terrifying stuff. But my mother, even my mom comments like, well, it's the same 20 English people on every show, so you get used to it, you know? Yeah, they just sort of rotate.
They don't have what you would call an array of actors to choose from. Because it's funny when they lose them all to America after a while. Like when Downton Abbey got big, you know, one by one, people began to die on the show.
A lot of
they
horse all got, carriage accidents. Like,
they all got
weird.
Offers to go work in America. Oh, yeah. The guy who played Beast in Disney's
Beauty
and the Beast was
horse.
Killed in a car wreck.
So, I don't know. I don't watch a lot of British television, but that's just the impression I get.
But yeah, that makes sense. You know, doing Shakespeare with kids, like one of the smarter things I've seen people do is when, like, you know, you've got a bunch of people on stage, you don't give them like a big ornate costume, you give them like a hat, and you're this guy, and the crown, you know, the king wears the crown, and this guy wears the sash, and that basically makes the actors interchangeable. You could just put on the one different piece of costume, and you're supposed to be, you know, and you're, the audience is supposed to make that leap with you to say that you're now this person. And as long as you are speaking the lines and, you know, going through the motions, we're supposed to believe that this is who you are. And that's just kind of how Shakespeare worked. Like, there was a lot of information in the dialogue to say, like, who the people were, where they were, what time it was. You know, there was no... It wasn't like a movie where you had all these other things to clue you in. Everything had to be spoken. So because of that, you didn't have to take a lot of... You didn't have to make much out of the set and the costumes. And so the people involved became, you know, interchangeable almost as easily as you could, just change your shirt. So that's how you get Doctor Who. So, yeah, maybe.
The next one is Thunderball.
Thunderball is that was the one that had them embroiled in legal issues for like 25 years.
You know who directed that?
The awful Never Say
Irvin
Never
Kershner.
Again.
Yeah.
Don't.
Weird, right?
Get out of town. For those of you who don't know, Irvin Kershner also directed The Empire Strikes Back. That's hysterical.
Thunderball was the guy, his Spectre guy. Emilio Largo.
Right.
He had like an eye patch.
Right, Largo. And he was...
The actor was Adolfo Celi, but he was also dubbed. So, I guess it's just easier to dub these people. I don't know.
Walken in the remake?
The Living Daylight? No. A View to a Kill. Else, in the remake, what was his name? I don't remember. Bad guy.
That's going to drive me nuts now. Never say.
Klaus Maria Brandauer. He played a different.
Oh, of course,
Lago. Yeah. Oh, him.
Tip of my tongue.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you wouldn't know him in much of anything. So.
Oh, yeah, but I've seen him in something. He's pretty weird looking. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, Thunderball's a good movie.
I actually like Thunderball a lot.
Yeah, no, that's a good one.
Yeah.
And it's good to see Spectre again. You know, it's good to rotate these things every so often.
Yeah, kind of keep the whole thing, you know.
Well, it's nice to know that he had...
Rotating. I'm tired.
What he said.
A better word.
What did you think of the movie? It was good.
Right, rotation.
Podcast over. So, all right. Anything else?
All right.
Were you drinking anything?
So, I'm exhausted.
I'm drinking the Voodoo Ranger IPA. It's brewed by the Fat Tire Brewing Company. Yeah. So it's left over from
Fat Tire, sure, yeah.
I'm not sure.
Where are they located?
Let's look at the bottle. New Belgium Brewing, Fort Collins, Colorado. Left over from my bachelor party.
That was a West Coast beer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't want to drink the Natty Bow, so I was like, let's have a real beer. Yeah. Yeah, and I was like, I'll never drink again.
It was a good time.
As I sip this. So that's how you know it was a good time.
Yeah, I was hurting that next day. Mostly because of the fact that we had played paintball the day before.
If I hadn't taken any Adderall, I'd have been dead. As I'm quick to remind everyone, I was like, if I hadn't taken that pill, there was no way I was going to be able to function. I was on no sleep and a waffle from the breakfast bar downstairs. It was
good. How was that breakfast bar? I never made it there.
I mean, I don't remember Saturday morning because I was just completely out of it. I remember eating a waffle and that's it. Apparently I was like talking to people and functioning, but I don't remember that. So on Sunday it was fine. I just couldn't taste anything. My taste buds were gone. You know. Yeah. Like I was eating bagels with oatmeal on it. I was like, whatever, I can't taste anything anyway. So
you know. Bagels with oatmeal.
Yeah. No, it was a good bachelor party.
Cheesy, so, crazy.
Good times. The way it should be. Like, we weren't gone for a week and a half. We just all met up somewhere and drank, and we had a good time. So, no.
No strippers.
Oh, were they?
Did I think the girls working at the brewery were thrilled about. They were nervous. They were like, are there strippers?
And we were the most tame group of people. It's really
fine. It's not going to get that weird. I know.
No,
I thought we were nervous.
We could have been.
No, we're just not that exciting. We're not that exciting. That's all.
Loud, I guess. Like any drunk would be. Yeah, good times.
What? Right.
Okay.
So, all right. Now that you've all enjoyed that segue for a minute and a half. So coming up next in this series will be Thunderball, and we're also going to begin taking a look at the Fast and the Furious films, as they are now apparently the most profitable things in cinema. And I really don't quite understand why, but I've never seen them. So we'll do we'll take a look at all of them, and then we'll do a definitive ranking.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun, too. In the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can tweet at us. We are at @3DrinksInPod. That's at @3DrinksInPod. We're on Instagram, @3DrinksInPodcast, Facebook. But most importantly, we really want you to go to iTunes and give us a rating. That's how we get the word out about how awesome we are. And that's if you give us those 5 stars.
The better reviews.
Four. I'll take 4.
You know, okay. The more stuff we can bring.
It costs you nothing, everybody.
If you do like it, we can give you more.
Exactly. So, please do that. We'd really appreciate that. If you want to leave a comment, that would be great, though you don't have to. Just the rating would be sufficient. Anything else we got to mention before we go? I think that's everything. All right. As always, please drink responsibly. And adios.
Goldfinger. He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch. A cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin. But don't go in. Golden words he will pour in your ear, but his lies can't disguise what you feel. The kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger. Pretty girl, beware of